He promised himself he would never let those hands harden. As Marilyn took the chicken, burnished and bronze, from the oven, he was mesmerized by her deftness. It was beautiful, the way broth thickened to gravy under her guidance, how potatoes fluffed like cotton beneath her fork. This was the closest thing he'd seen to magic. A few months later, when they married, they would make a pact to let the past drift away, to stop asking questions, to look forward from then on, never back. That spring, Marilyn was making plans for her senior year. James was finishing his PhD and waiting, still, to see if he would be taken on in the history department. There was an opening, and he had applied, and Professor Carlson, the department head, had hinted he was by far the most accomplished in his class. Now and then he would interview for positions elsewhere, in New Haven, in Providence, just in case. Deep inside, though, he was certain that he would be hired at Harvard. "Carlson as good as told me I'm in," he said to Marilyn whenever the subject came up. Marilyn nodded and kissed him, and refused to think about what would happen when she graduated the next year. When she headed off to medical school, who knew where? Harvard, she thought, ticking off her fingers. Columbia, Johns Hopkins, Stanford. Each digit a step farther away. Then, in April, two things neither of them expected. Professor Carlson informed James that he was very, very sorry to disappoint him, but they had decided to take his classmate, William McPherson, instead. And of course they knew James would find many other opportunities elsewhere. "Did they say why?" Marilyn asked. And James replied, "I wasn't the right fit for the department," they said. And she did not raise the subject again. 4 days later, an even bigger surprise. Marilyn was pregnant. So instead of Harvard, an offer at last from humble Middlewood College, accepted with relief. Instead of Boston, small-town Ohio. Instead of medical school, a wedding. Nothing quite as planned. "A baby," Marilyn said to James over and over. "Our baby. So much better." By the time they were married, Marilyn would be only 3 months along, and it wouldn't show. To herself, she said, "You can come back and finish that last year, when the baby is older." It would be almost 8 years before school would seem real and possible and tangible again. But Marilyn didn't know that. As she left the dean's office, an indefinite leave secured, she was certain that everything she had dreamed for herself, medical school, doctorhood, that new and important life, sat poised for her return like a well-trained dog awaiting its master. Still, when Marilyn sat down at the telephone table in the dorm lobby and gave the long-distance operator her mother's number, her voice shook with each digit. As her mother's voice finally came over the line, she forgot to say hello. Instead, she blurted out, "I'm getting married. In June." Her mother paused. "Who is he?" "His name is James Lee." "A student?" Marilyn's face warmed. "He's just finishing his PhD in American history." She hesitated and decided on a half-truth. "Harvard was thinking of hiring him in the fall." "So he's a professor." A sudden alertness tinted her mother's voice. "Sweetheart, I'm so happy for you. I can't wait to meet him." Relief flooded Marilyn. Her mother wasn't upset about her leaving school early. Why would she mind? Hadn't she done just what her mother had hoped? Met a wonderful Harvard man? She read off the information from a slip of paper. Friday, June 13th, 11:30, with the Justice of the Peace. Lunch afterward at the Parker House. It won't be a big party. Just us and you and a few of our friends. James's parents are both dead. Lee, her mother mused. Is he connected to anyone we know? Marilyn realized suddenly what her mother was imagining. It was 1958. In Virginia, in half the country, their wedding would break the law. Even in Boston, she sometimes saw disapproval in the eyes of the passers-by. Her hair was no longer the white blonde of her childhood, but it was still light enough to catch attention when bent toward James's inky black head in movie theaters, on a park bench, at the counter at the Waldorf cafeteria. A gaggle of Radcliffe girls came down the stairs, one hovering nearby to wait for the phone, the others crowding around the hall mirror to apply powder to their noses. One of them, just a week before, had heard about Marilyn's marriage and came by her room to see if it was really true. Marilyn squeezed the receiver and pressed one palm to her belly and kept her voice sweet. "I don't know, Mother," she said. "Why don't you ask him when you meet him?" So her mother came in from Virginia, the first time she'd ever left the state. Standing at the station with James hours after his graduation, waiting for her mother's train, Marilyn told herself, she would have come anyway, even if I'd told her. Her mother stepped onto the platform and spotted Marilyn, and a smile flashed across her face, spontaneous, proud. And for that instant, Marilyn believed it completely. Of course she would have. Then the smile flickered just for a moment, like a flash of static. Her gaze darted back and forth between the stout blonde woman standing on her daughter's left and the skinny Oriental man on her right, looking for the advertised James, not finding him. Finally understanding. A few seconds passed before she shook James's hand, told him she was very, very happy to meet him, and allowed him to take her bag. Marilyn and her mother had dinner alone that night, and her mother did not mention James until dessert. She knew what her mother would ask. "Why do you love him?" and steeled herself for the question. But her mother didn't ask this at all, didn't mention the word love. Instead, she swallowed a bite of cake and studied her daughter from across the table. "You're sure," she said, "that he doesn't just want a green card?" Marilyn couldn't look at her. Instead, she stared at her mother's hands, spotted despite the gloves and the lemon-scented lotion. At the fork pinched between the fingers, at the crumb clinging to the tines. A tiny wrinkle creased her mother's eyebrows, as if someone had nicked her forehead with a knife. Years later, Anna would spy this same mark of deep worry on her mother's face, though she would not know its source, and Marilyn would never have admitted the resemblance. "He was born in California, Mother," she said, and her mother looked away, dabbed at her mouth with her napkin, leaving two red smears on the linen. The morning of the wedding, as they waited in the courthouse, Marilyn's mother kept fiddling with the clasp of her purse. They'd gotten there almost an hour early, worried about traffic, about parking, about missing their spot with the Justice of the Peace. James had put on a new suit and kept patting the breast pocket, checking for the rings through the navy blue wool. Such a timid and nervous gesture made Marilyn want to kiss him right there in front of everyone. In 25 minutes, she would be his wife. and then her mother stepped closer and took Marilyn's elbow in a grip that felt like a clamp. "Let's touch up your lipstick," she said, nudging Marilyn toward the ladies' room. She should have known it was coming. All morning her mother had been dissatisfied with everything. Marilyn's dress wasn't white but cream. It didn't look like a wedding dress. It was too plain, like something a nurse would wear. She didn't know why Marilyn wouldn't get married in a church. There were plenty nearby. She didn't like the weather in Boston. Why was it so gray in June? Daisies weren't a wedding flower. Why not roses instead? And why was she in such a hurry? Why get married now? Why not wait a while? It would have been easier if her mother had used a slur. It would have been easier if she had insulted James outright. If she had said he was too short, or too poor, or not accomplished enough. But all her mother said, over and over, was, "It's not right, Marilyn. It's not right." Leaving it unnamed, hanging in the air between them. Marilyn pretended not to hear and took her lipstick from her purse. "You'll change your mind," her mother said. "You'll regret it later." Marilyn swiveled up the tube and bent close to the mirror, and her mother grabbed her by both shoulders suddenly, desperately. The look in her eyes was fear, as if Marilyn were running along the edge of a cliff. "Think about your children," she said. "Where will you live? You won't fit in anywhere. You'll be sorry for the rest of your life." "Stop it," Marilyn shouted, slamming her fist against the edge of the sink. "This is my life, Mother. Mine." She jerked herself free and the lipstick went flying, then skittered to a stop on the floor tiles. Somehow she had made a long red streak down her mother's sleeve. Without another word, she pushed the door of the bathroom open, leaving her mother alone. Outside, James glanced anxiously at his wife-to-be. "What's wrong?" he murmured, leaning close. She shook her head and whispered quickly, laughingly, "Oh, my mother just thinks I should marry someone more like me." Then she took his lapel in her fist, pulled his face to hers, and kissed him. "Ridiculous," she thought. So obvious that she didn't even need to say it. Just days before, hundreds of miles away, another couple had married too. A white man, a black woman, who would share a most appropriate name. Loving. In 4 months, they would be arrested in Virginia, the law reminding them that Almighty God had never intended white, black, yellow, and red to mix, that there should be no mongrel citizens, no obliteration of racial pride. It would be 4 years before they protested, and 4 years more before the court concurred, but many more years before the people around them would, too. Some, like Marilyn's mother, never would. When Marilyn and James separated, her mother had returned from the ladies' room and stood silently watching them from a distance. She had blotted her sleeve again and again on the roller towel, but the red mark still showed beneath the damp spot, like an old bloodstain. Marilyn wiped a smudge of lipstick from James's upper lip and grinned, and he patted his breast pocket again, checking the rings. To her mother, it looked as if James were congratulating himself. Afterward, the wedding reduced to a slideshow in Marilyn's memory, the thin white line like a hair in the justice's bifocals, the knots of baby's breath in her bouquet, the fog of moisture on the wine glass her old roommate Sandra raised to toast. Under the table, James's hand in hers, the strange new band of gold cool against her skin. And across the table, her mother's carefully curled hair, her powdered face, her lips kept closed to cover the crooked incisor. That was the last time Marilyn saw her mother. 3. Until the day of the funeral, Marilyn has never thought about the last time she would see her daughter. She would have imagined a touching bedside scene, like in the movies. Herself white-haired and elderly and content, in a satin bed jacket, ready to say her goodbyes. Lydia, a grown woman, confident and poised, holding her mother's hands in hers, a doctor by then, unfazed by the great cycle of life and death. And Lydia, though Marilyn does not admit it, is the face she would want to see last. Not Nath, or Hannah, or even James, but the daughter she thinks of first and always. Now her last glimpse of Lydia has already passed. James, to her bewilderment, has insisted on a closed casket funeral. She will not even get to see her daughter's face one last time. And for the past 3 days, she has told James this over and over, sometimes furious, sometimes through tears. James, for his part, cannot find the words to tell her what he discovered on going to identify Lydia's body. There is only half a face left, barely preserved by the cold water of the lake. The other half had already been eaten away. He ignores his wife and keeps his eyes trained on the rearview mirror as he backs into the street. The cemetery is only a 15-minute walk from their house, but they drive anyway. As they turn onto the main road that circles the lake, Marilyn looks sharply to the left, as if she's spotted something on the shoulder of her husband's jacket. She doesn't want to see the pier, the rowboat now remoored, the lake itself stretching out into the distance. James has the car windows rolled up tight, but the breeze shakes the leaves of the trees on the banks and corrugates the surface of the water. It will be there forever, the lake. Every time they leave their house, they will see it. In the back seat, Nath and Hannah wonder in unison if their mother will turn her head away for the rest of her life, every time she passes by. The lake glints in the sun like a shiny tin roof, and Nath's eyes begin to water. It seems inappropriate for the light to be so bright, for the sky to be so blue, and he's relieved when a cloud drifts over the sun and the water turns from silver to gray. At the cemetery, they pull into the parking lot. Middlewood is proud of its garden cemetery, a sort of graveyard and botanical garden in one, with winding paths and small brass signs to identify the flora. Nath remembers middle school science trips with sketch pads and field guides. Once the teacher had promised 10 extra credit points to the person who could gather the most kinds of leaves. There had been a funeral that day, too. And Tommy Reed had tiptoed between rows of folding chairs to the sassafras tree, right in the middle of the eulogy, and plucked a leaf from a low-hanging branch. Mr. Rexford hadn't noticed, and had complimented Tommy on being the only one to find sassafras albidum, and the whole class had stifled giggles and high-fived Tommy on the bus ride home. Now, as they walk single file toward the cluster of chairs set up in the distance, Nath wants to go back in time and punch Tommy Reed. In Lydia's honor, the school has closed for the day, and Lydia's classmates come, lots of them. Looking at them, James and Marilyn realize just how long it has been since they've seen these girls. Years. For a moment, they don't recognize Karen Adler with her hair grown long, or Pam Saunders without her braces. James, thinking of the crossed-out list of names, finds himself staring and turns away. Slowly, the chairs fill with some of Nath's classmates. With juniors and freshmen he finds vaguely familiar but doesn't really know. Even the neighbors, as they file in, feel like strangers. His parents never go out or entertain. They have no dinner parties, no bridge group, no hunting buddies or luncheon packs.